Continue to look at the Sermon on the Mount and are in that section of that sermon that talks about being blessed in the kingdom of God. That section that we normally refer to as the Beatitudes, and we'll be picking up looking at two more of those this morning, and that'll leave us two to finish out with before we begin the next quarter, where we're going to actually be tying the lessons into the Bible classes as well, because there are some things in the Sermon on the Mount that are fairly challenging, I think, and that will give us opportunity to get some questions and answers and feedback from the group in the Bible class when we start that next class on the next quarter. The quarter that was originally scheduled to be on the family will be the first quarter of 2014, if the Lord permits us to continue to meet that long. Jesus has, I think, in these Beatitudes, started with one that just kind of positioned everybody that was going to be in the kingdom, that understood the nature of the kingdom. And that was the idea of being blessed are those who are poor in spirit. And if we have the right view of ourselves and put ourselves in the proper place, then it just seems that the other things that Jesus is going to talk about and the other characteristics he's going to list, the things that he's going to ask us to do or things that he says that we should be in the verses that follow this, just kind of fall into place. And that's always been the case with God. That's the way he approaches, I think, life for us. He says, I need to get you to think a certain way first. If I can get you to think a certain way, then it's easier to get people to follow in the actions that he talks about. I think that's why Paul says things like he said in Colossians when he said, if you've been raised with Christ, or since then you've been raised with Christ, he says, set your mind on things above. I think that's why some 10 different times in the book of Philippians, he talks about what we ought to think or where our mind ought to be in order that we can follow it with certain actions. I think Jesus does the same thing. And as he continues to work his way down through these Beatitudes, you find that some of them seem to get a little more difficult. Because now they're no longer just what I think. They're no longer just my attitude toward God. With these that we're beginning with today, it's not just attitude towards self and attitude towards God, but it's going to talk about the attitude toward other people and how we reach out to others, how we react with and to others, depending on the things that they do. And he starts with one that is going to be, I think, as challenging in our world as probably about anything else could be. Probably was challenging in their world as well. If you remember, they were part of the Roman Empire at this time, and so the world that they were in, different ways to be involved in the vices that they were in, but they were a nation that was pretty similar to United States of America modern times as far as the amount of vice that was in that society, in that kingdom, the amount of self-seeking that went on there, the amount of people that were focused on themselves and their own rights and their own pleasures and all the things that went along with that. He's going to say, to start with today, blessed are the merciful. This is entirely different because it is a quality that is concerned primarily, if not only, with the good of others. Mercy is virtually a completely outward look. I think it stems from an inward look. I think to understand why and how he says that we need to be merciful, how that's a characteristic of us, that becomes a strongest characteristic in my life, or a strong characteristic in my life, when it springs from the realization of the mercy that I have received. And I think God needs us to get that picture correct. So he's going to say, blessed are the merciful. And he goes on to say also, but why? Because they shall obtain mercy. I don't think that's a mercy that they'll obtain from other people. They may or may not obtain mercy from other people. But it's mercy that they'll obtain from God. And he's going to say, blessed are the merciful. Interesting word, and sometimes we're a little bit challenged, I think, with this word. The word in the Greek is eleos, and it is a word that we sometimes have difficulty separating from the Greek word charis, which is grace. And so we talk about mercy and grace, and they go hand in hand, no question about that. They're used together frequently in the New Testament, but they're not the same word. They have different focuses, really. I think one kind of stems from the other, but sometimes helpful to understand the difference between these two. The Greek word charis is kindness which bestows upon one what he has not deserved. That's Thayer's definition. It's kindness that's bestowed on one that he hasn't deserved. We understand that. We use phrases like unmerited favor. In other words, the fact that God sent Jesus to this earth to die, we say was a demonstration of the grace of God. We didn't deserve that. We know that. But that was a kindness that was extended toward us. It was an act of kindness, and that's the nature of grace. Mercy is a little bit different in that it's the moral quality of feeling, compassion, and especially of showing kindness towards someone in need. This can refer to human kindness and to God's kindness to humankind. I know those sound very similar. But I think the difference is what it is that the person is looking at and what it is that they're extending, why it is that they are extending that. Martin Lloyd-Jones, in his book Studies in the Sermon on the Mount, said this: grace is especially associated with men in their sins. Mercy is especially associated with men in their misery. I like that. In other words, while grace looks down upon sin as a whole, mercy looks especially upon the miserable consequences of sin. So that mercy really means a sense of pity plus a desire to relieve the suffering. Vines goes on to say it's an outward manifestation of pity. It assumes need on the part of him who receives it and resources adequate to meet the need on the part of him who shows it. It is compassion and pity channeled into active benevolence toward another person. For example, an enemy or person in need, he says. And so as I look at other people, I think this is what he's saying. I can be gracious to other people. And I can tell you that they're not only from God. There are gifts I've gotten all throughout my life that I didn't deserve. I understand that. I mean, other people have been gracious to me and given me gifts that I didn't deserve. I've given gifts that weren't deserved. And anybody who has raised three teenagers understands that concept very well. Allowing them the gift of life on occasion is an act of grace. We understand that. No, we give gifts that we don't deserve. But that's different than seeing the misery that somebody is in and extending to them mercy, because I understand something here. I understand that I have received the mercy of God. And that's why I'm merciful. It shows itself in different ways. Let's just think in terms of some people, because sometimes it's easier to recognize than it is to just strictly define. I want you to turn, if you would, to Genesis chapter 14. Genesis chapter 14. Starting in verse 12. They also took Lot, Abram's brother's son, who dwelt in Sodom, and his goods, and departed. Then one who had escaped came and told Abram, the Hebrew, for he dwelt by the terebinth trees of Mamre, the Amorite, brother of Eshcol and brother of Aner. And they were allies with Abram. Now when Abram heard that his brother was taken captive, he armed his 318 trained servants who were born, and my contact just shifted, and I'm sorry, I lost all the legible words. All right, let's pick that up again. Who were born in his own house and went in pursuit as far as Dan. He divided his forces against them by night, and he and his servants attacked them and pursued them as far as Hobnah, which is north of Damascus. So he brought back all the goods, brought back his brother Lot and his goods, as well as the women and the people. And the king of Sodom went out to meet him in the valley. It goes on to talk about, and after the return, the defeat of Chorlamer and the kings who were with him. And then he meets Melchizedek, and you've got this offering of Abraham to Melchizedek. And you think in terms of the attitudes that Abram displays toward other people. When you remember when Lot was first taken captive, and Abram's plea with God was what? Was, please don't destroy everybody. Don't destroy everybody. There may be somebody that is not guilty. If you would, please save the ones that are not guilty. Or you think of, even though it was brought on by himself, you think of Joseph in Genesis chapter 45. When Joseph found his brothers with the cup in the bag. You remember that? Or even prior to that. Just the fact that they came to Joseph for grain in Egypt. I don't know. I had two brothers. Rare would be the occasion that I could see myself playing the role of Joseph with my two brothers. Had they done to me what Joseph's brothers did to him? We had three sons. I would tell you, it would be a pretty rare occasion to have expected either of the sons to act that way toward his brothers if they had done to him what Joseph had done to him by his brothers. And yet his brothers came to collect grain. And Joseph saw his brothers, and then in particular when they brought Benjamin back, and Joseph is just weeping, and he feels for them, and he extends toward them the mercy that they don't deserve, but the pain that he has felt himself. Moses was one who extended mercy to others. Maybe the greatest picture of all in the Bible, in the New Testament, is the Good Samaritan, because I think this is what helps us to understand how mercy fulfills itself. Three men found this guy on the side of the road that had been beaten by robbers, left for dead. What did the priest think? What did the Levite think? Do you have any idea? Did they feel sorry for the man on the side of the road? I don't know what they felt. The passage doesn't really give us a great description of what was going on inside their minds. They may not have been different than the Samaritan in what they felt. They were different in what? What they did. Mercy sees the need and acts upon the need. It has to do both. That's the nature of the Samaritan. It's Jesus hanging on the cross and saying that, God, forgive them. They're nailing me to the cross. They don't understand what they are doing. If they understood, truly understood what they were doing, they would never do this. It's a part of God's nature. And so if we think about mercy, I think the point for us is, mercy is more than what we feel. Mercy is what we do. And that's why we need to be the kind of people who not only see needs, who not only feel compassion, who do something about it. We've used this illustration before. But it's one of those things that always kind of plucks at my heartstrings. You know, you're walking through a place like a Disney World, and we've talked about, and you see that little lost child. Can you ever imagine what it would be like to, as an adult? As an adult, you see that child, and they're crying over there, and you know why they're crying. They're looking around. Their parents aren't around. They have no idea what to do. Can you imagine yourself saying, well, I just feel so sorry for that child. How long's the line for the next ride? Let's go get in line for the next ride. I feel so badly for that child. But I'm just going to walk on. I'm going to get myself something to eat. I mean, that just seems beyond imagination to us, does it not? I'm saying as an adult. I mean, hope it does. Hopefully we would see that child in need And we would want to go over and we'd want to do whatever we could to help the child in need. Why? Because the kind of compassion that God has for us stirs Him to action. Jesus, when He looked out on the crowds and felt compassion, was always stirred to action. It does more than feel sorry. It meets the needs. We need to understand that we've even talked about that in our Bible class. There are a lot of needs that people have. Christians have to understand that we're living in a world of hurting people. And they're hurting and they're bothered by many things. We need to be a people who sees need and steps into the breach. Does something in action to stimulate those who are in need. To do what we can to fulfill that need. It takes the gospel to the world. You ever just hurt because there's lost people? I'm telling you, when Jesus broke down and cried over Jerusalem, that to me may be one of the most, I don't know if shameful would be a proper, I'm going to have to look at the English on that, but it would be a shaming verse. I just wonder how many times have I just sat down and wept because the world around me is lost. That's what Jesus did. Looked at Jerusalem, broke down, sobbed, and cried. And He did everything He could to try to get the message of the kingdom to them. We need to have a compassion on this world, but we have to take the gospel to them. If we do not, we lack mercy. We may have compassion, but I don't want to be like the priest who may have walked by and may have felt very sorry for that guy on the side of the road, but didn't do anything. We need to take it to him. It forgives. Why does it forgive? Because that's something that God pressures us into, something that God is trying to create in us and just saying, look, you're obligated to forgive. I teach a lesson in some of the marriage seminars that I do talking about one of the points is forgiveness is an act of will. And it is. You have to determine to forgive. But God's not just saying, you forgive because I tell you to forgive. He's saying, forgive because you understand what it means to be forgiven. Mercy. Granting mercy to others. We understand what it means to be blinded by the god of this world, Satan. And I want to help others who are also blinded by him. Our attitude toward other people has changed because now we have genuine sorrow over our own sins and genuine appreciation for the forgiveness that we have received for those sins. Love this quote I came across from John Ruskin. God can forgive the passing sin of the hot heart, but not the inherent sin of the cold. I like that quote. God's a forgiving God. But if my heart is cold, there is no forgiveness really to be granted. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. I think truly any time that I am not merciful toward my fellow man, there's only one explanation, and that's that I don't understand the mercy that God has given me. I've fallen short somewhere in that understanding of what I have received. Secondly, he says, blessed are the pure in heart. Verse 8, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. That's not even a new teaching. Jesus didn't originate that thought any more than he originated these other thoughts. These are godly characteristics. Back in the Psalms in verse 24, who may ascend into the hill of the Lord, or who may stand in his holy place? He who has clean hands and a pure heart. And we understand the word heart there, and the word heart as it's used in the New Testament there, Matthew chapter 5, is the word cardia in the Greek. Same word we get cardiac from, or all the other things that are associated with the heart medically. But he's not talking literally about the heart.
He's talking about the very essence of our life. We understand that. So he's talking about whatever this purity is, it is the very essence of our life, or the very spirit of the man himself. It is who we are, what we are in the world around us. And he uses a great word here in the Greek. Uses the word katharos in the Greek. Literally means pure from defilement. Unalloyed. That's kind of an interesting definition, isn't it? But we understand that. That's a word that's used as associated with precious metals. You go in to buy a ring, and they want to tell you what? There are rings that are gold-filled, gold-plated, 10-carat, 14-carat, 18-carat, and they'll know that you'd find one or many, but there are some that are 24-carat. They don't make them in 24-carat typically. Why? Because that's pure gold. It's too soft. But we understand all of the others have something mixed with them. That's why they mix it with them. They don't mix it with them to make your ring cheaper. They mix it with your gold to make the ring, the gold harder, so that it will sustain the use of jewelry. So they mix it, and it has an alloy mixed with it, different kinds of things. Now, some things are done in order to make it cheaper. You remember when nickels used to be made out of nickel? You know, they aren't any longer. You remember when pennies used to be pure copper, or quarters used to be pure silver, and they started mixing all of those. Why? Because it was a whole lot cheaper than making them out of those more precious metals. But you mix an alloy, and he's saying that the pure heart is a heart that has not been mixed with anything else. It isn't really a description of a life that has no impurity in it. We all struggle with that. None of us achieve purity in the sense of perfection. But it's really dealing more with the idea of a singleness of mind. It's used interchangeably with two other Greek words. You'll see them throughout the New Testament, all dealing with the same kind of thing. When it's applied to a person, it describes purity of heart, motivations, and behavior. Sincere honesty and absolute integrity. That's the nature of what he's saying. Those that are pure in heart, it's not just a moral characteristic. We'll see that in a moment. It is more than that. He's talking about the nature of being cleansed. That word katharos, does that look familiar at all? We get the word catharsis or cathartic from it. Somebody sometimes will say things like, "Wow, that was very cathartic to do that." To have been there. Or psychiatrists and psychologists will use that term. They will talk about catharsis, which is it's a cleansing of the mind is what they're talking about. It is going in and removing all the things that are bad in there in order that it can only be pure and ready for good thought. That's exactly what God's talking about. He says those who have cleansed themselves, those who have focused in a different direction. Before I became a Christian, I can tell you what the main battle was in my life, because it's exactly the same thing that always creates the battle when it creeps back in. And that's when there are some divided attentions in my life. Prior to becoming a Christian, my goal was never to have God only first and everything else second. That wasn't even my goal before being a Christian. I understand that. And so there was always a fighting. And so sometimes it would be pulled in this direction and that direction. But when I was baptized into Jesus Christ, the idea is, what I have said now is, I've cleansed myself of me. That's the nature of putting on Christ. So that I can be absolutely pure, singly focused, only directed at God. And that's what he's saying that we are. It's a catharsis in a sense of this cleaning out of the mind and the emotions so that I'm focused only toward God. And so as we think about that, it starts with a condition of the heart, because all life flows from an abundance from the heart. That's why he's saying you've got to have purity of heart first. You've got to think the right way first in order that you can follow with the proper actions. We understand that. Jesus and so did writers in the Old Testament and the Psalms. They said, as it's in your heart, that's who you're going to be. He says you have to be right on the inside We sing a song with the kids that, I don't know, have you seen, maybe you've seen the new Sonic commercial. I get a kick out of the Sonic guys. The new Sonic commercial, the debate is over the crispy chicken tenders or whatever they're calling them that they're eating. And the one guy's contention is what makes them so good is because they look so good on the outside. And so they make a whole play on that. You know, the other guy's going, well, nobody ever says that. Everybody always says it's what's on the inside that counts. And the other guy is saying, no, you know, it's the appearance. It's how it looks that matters. We sing a song with the kids from the inside out. That's the way God's looking at me. That's what Jesus is talking about. He's saying, I need to start because however I am inside, that's how I'm going to be on the outside. That's what flows forth, the abundance of my heart. And so as we think about that, in one commentary, in Francis' commentary, he says, pure in heart should not be restricted to moral, still less to sexual. We think purity, we automatically think sexual. But that's not what this word means here, even though it would include that. Still less sexual purity. It denotes one who loves God with all his heart, as in Deuteronomy 6. With an undivided loyalty and whose inward nature corresponds with his outward profession. Single-minded loyalty to God, Zondervan says, as it affects every area of life. A heart that's been enlightened by God and is singly focused. And that's what he's saying. I need to have God absolutely as my focus as I'm going to reach out toward others. He says, they shall see God. Those that are pure in heart shall see God. How are you going to see God? I don't think it's talking about just his presence, that you're going to come into his presence. Everybody's going to do that. Everybody will see God. That's what Philippians 2 tells us. Every single knee shall bow. Every single tongue shall confess. That's what Philippians 2 says. Everybody's coming into the presence of God. That's not it. It's more than even just some of the things that we learn. It really is a true discernment. One of the great descriptions of this, I think, or pictures of this, is back in Job. Remember Job and the discussions that he was having with God and with his friends? Do you remember what Job said toward the end of the book, or at the very end of the book, really? He said, I have heard with the hearing. He's talking about his previously. I knew about God, he says. I'd heard a lot of things about God. He had misunderstood some things. God straightened him out on a few. He said, but now I see God. Now I see. He's just saying, I understand completely differently. If I love God the way he wants me to love him, and that is my heart, it is absolutely, totally dedicated to God. He says, I'll understand God. I'll see him. Doesn't mean I'll have all of life figured out. But he says, I'll get the right picture of God. Because that's what I am seeking. The Hebrews used it as an expression of great favor. See face to face. Paul said that. Say, we see in part today, but we'll see face to face. He wasn't just saying that someday we'll be in the presence of. He's saying someday we'll be right there with God. It's an expression of favor. And that's what I think Jesus is saying. Those that are pure in heart, singly focused on God. He said those will have the favor of God. How great of a blessing is that if the promise is you seek God with all your heart. You love God with all your heart. You be absolutely pure and you'll have God's favor. That's a great promise that God makes to us. The question is, do you want to see God? Because that's what the promise is in Matthew 5. Do you want to see God? He says, well then, that's going to have to be the single focus of your life. has to come first. I need to see God because I seek God more than anything else. He said, when my heart is pure, because I'd love to say that since I've become a Christian, Mark has never come back into that heart and had tug of war with the priorities of his life and with God, but he has. Never works in my favor, but I can assure you it's happened. But when I'm closest to my God is when I can get rid of Mark and be totally focused, totally dedicated on God. It isn't what's on the outside. Jesus said to the Pharisees, they looked wonderful on the outside. But he said, inwardly they were dead. They were full of sin. They were like beautiful tombs that are built, that you can stand back and just be impressed with the majestic nature of it. But he said, and it doesn't change the fact that they're full of dead man's bones. I want to see God. I need to make Him first in my life. If that's what you want to do today, make God first in your life. If you've never done that before, don't know how, we'd love to show you from His Word why He says you should be buried in baptism and raised in newness of life. If you already know that, we hope you'll take care of it. For those of us that are Christians, may we continue to fight that ongoing battle of keeping our hearts absolutely pure, totally dedicated, not mixed with any of the alloys of life, only full of God. If we can help you, let us know while we stand and sing.